From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the author Meg Wolitzer about her novel for young adults, Beljar, which was published by Dutton Books for Young Readers. Meg Wolitzer is the New York Times bestselling author of The Interestings, The Uncoupling, The 10-Year Nap, The Position, and The Wife. We also discussed her novel, The Female Persuasion, a few years after this one that you're about to hear now. That was named a most anticipated book of the year by Time Magazine, Esquire Entertainment Weekly, New York Magazine, and more. She was the guest editor of the Best American Short Stories 2017, and she lives in New York City. And I saw earlier from her Twitter feed that she has been made the new host of Selected Shorts. Here's a little information about her YA novel, Beljar, which we discussed in this archive interview. There's a place where the lost go to be found. If life were fair, Jam Gallahue would still be at home in New Jersey with her sweet British boyfriend, Reeve Maxfield. She'd be watching old comedy sketches with him. She'd be kissing him in the library stacks. She certainly wouldn't be at the Wooden Barn, a therapeutic boarding school in rural Vermont, signed up for an exclusive, supposedly life-changing class called Special Topics in English that focuses only and entirely on the works of Sylvia Plath. But life isn't fair. Reeve has been gone for almost a year, and Jam is still mourning. When a journal writing assignment leads Jam into a mysterious other world she and her classmates call Beljar, she discovers a realm where the untainted past is restored, and she can feel Reeve's arms around her once again. But as the pages of her journal begin to fill up, Jam must confront hidden truths and ultimately decide what she's willing to sacrifice to reclaim her loss. When I spoke to Meg Wolitzer, whose books have mostly been for adults, I began by asking her how she decided to write her new novel, Beljar, for a younger audience. I should say that she's gone on to write some picture books, too. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, you know, I had often written about adolescence in my novels for adults, so it really wasn't that much of a stretch for me. Mm-hmm. In addition, I had a teenage son at home at the time, and he had read some young adult books and really been affected by them, so it was kind of in the air.
Yeah, okay. And did you, well, so it sounds like maybe it wasn't an entire change of pace for you, but did you enjoy the difference that that was?
Oh, absolutely. You know, whatever you do in writing, I mean, you have to do as well as you can. And I just read a lot of books, and I tried to sort of see what would have been appealing to me as, you know, say a 14-year-old at the time. What book would I have wanted to read, and what elements would it have contained, and how would it have felt? And I think the voice was terribly important, getting the kind of breathless, urgent, first-person voice that I wanted from my narrator.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved Jam, and I did. I thought her voice was perfect. In developing her character, did you find yourself drawing more on maybe your own kids or their friends or your own teenage self in sort of figuring out Jam and her friends?
You know, it's, of course, not autobiographical at all, but I did draw on my own self as a teenager, just sort of that feeling, I think, that a lot of teenagers have, which is that nothing will get better, that things are so bad right now, and that kind of intensity. You know, you may have problems with your friends or whatever it is, you feel it in a magnified way. I try not to draw from my kids or...
Yeah, no, I mean, not like personal stories. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I wondered if writing this brought back any memories from your own teenage years. Did stuff come up that you weren't expecting? Or
I don't know that I wasn't expecting it. I always expect when I'm writing that I'll think about a lot of things and details will come up. You know, because this book takes place now, I wasn't putting in period details the way I did in my last novel, The Interesting, mm-hmm. which starts in the 1970s, and I would remember things like Love's Fresh Lemon Shampoo and the way my earth shoes felt, and things that I really hadn't thought about in a very, very long time. Yeah. Here, I did, you know, yeah, I remember the feeling when I was writing Beljar of being solitary, being, you know, a girl alone in the world, going to school. I mean, I have kids, I have a husband, I have a dog, I have a very big, you know, life. I give a lot of readings and go around and do stuff. And back then, you know, your life is really kind of pared down. You go to school, you come home, and I could picture myself really sort of walking around and, you know, just being this girl of that age in that era. And it was sort of painful, not that I was unhappy, but it brought up that feeling of, mm-hmm. you know, when you don't really have a lot of agency when you're in school, when you're young. And I wanted to kind of amplify that.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as the specific story of Beljar goes, I'm wondering if there was a certain point of inspiration for you, or just was it a character that you wanted to open up, or how did that start for you?
I had had a kind of long relationship with Sylvia Plath because mm-hmm. I actually had won the Mademoiselle Guest Editor Contest that she won, and which is the whole beginning of the Beljar, takes place at a magazine for women when the character has won this contest. And, you know, this was a big thing. We were the last ones to win it before they folded the contest for good, and finally Mademoiselle magazine, which was somewhere between Glamour and Vogue, you know, like the collegiate version, a little sort of preppy women who were smart, that folded too. And, you know, I just sort of felt this connection to Plath having had that same position. And my first novel, which I sold when I was in college, dealt with some college students who were called the Death Girls on their campus because they worshipped some female poets who took their own lives, and one of them was Plath. And mm-hmm. I invented my own poet. So I think that Plath was very durable to me as someone who a certain kind of bookish, sensitive girl would be interested in. But, you know, going around and talking to people now, a lot of young people haven't read The Beljar, haven't read Plath's poetry. It doesn't matter in terms of reading my book or not. I mean, I think it's really, I'm trying to tap into that feeling of oversensitivity and a hyper-awareness that happens in adolescence.
Yeah, I did think you did a really good job of writing about Plath so that people who hadn't read her would understand something about what she was about and what her life was about, but also okay. relating it into this story. But I wondered, as I was reading, did you was there a part of you that hoped to help your readers through difficult times of their own, or were you just telling a story?
I think they're sort of inextricable. I mean, I think that if you set out to use fiction to help, it isn't often, it isn't often doable in that way. It doesn't work that way. It's not a pamphlet, you know?
Right.
But I think if you try to write the truth about life the way you know best, somehow that can help people, and you hear from them that it helped them. But not often in the ways that you imagined that it would. It's all very different. So no, I mean, yes and no. I set about to write a novel that showed someone's inner life, and a not very reliable narrator kind of coming to face her own life. And if that makes readers think about themselves, which invariably to some extent it does, mm-hmm. it could be helpful, but not more I didn't think of it more directly than that.
Which is probably appropriate, because if there's any one audience that doesn't want to be lectured to, it's teenagers.
Yeah, right. Tell me about it. I know.
So one aspect of this novel, Beljar, is that your protagonist, Jam, is in a school for kids who've been through a rough time, I would say. And that school is in Vermont. And since I am in Vermont and my show is in Burlington, Vermont, I just want to talk a little bit about your decision to base the school, which is called the Wooden Barn, in Vermont.
Well, I think Vermont holds a certain kind of magic for a lot of people, myself included. Mm-hmm. It just seems it's north, it's beautiful, it's progressive in some ways. It's an interesting place where I've spent time and loved. So it just sort of stood. Also, it just sort of seemed like the opposite of New Jersey in some ways.
Yeah.
At least the suburban New Jersey part of New Jersey where Jam comes from, which is described as sort of having a lot of malls. I know there must be malls in Vermont, but I haven't been to them. I have been on, you know, leaf-going trips and that kind of thing.
Right.
So I think of Vermont as a place that is evocative to the reader. You just sort of say Vermont, and the reader pictures certain things. Mm-hmm. So that maybe that was why.
Okay, great. The class that Jam is in that a lot of the action revolves around is called the Special Topics in English class, and it's kind of a secret society. It's highly selective, and the teacher, Mrs. Cannell, handpicks her students. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit about secret societies as part of a story for young readers, and was it important to you that Jam be handpicked for something important and small and secret?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that really, it was just sort of irresistible to me to have a class that is special and you don't know what's going on in it from the outside, because it creates, I mean, it's sort of like there's a corollary with books themselves, which mm-hmm. I consider hot objects. I've sort of referred to them that way before. I mean, I think books can contain truths and feelings and ideas that you wouldn't be able to talk about freely in your life, but when you read about it, there's this intimacy between you and the book, you and the page. And I wanted to sort of extend that to this class, that it was going to be an experience that was sort of like reading a book, mm-hmm. that it's secret, it's private, it's selective, it's you know, you were chosen. Sometimes you feel like you're chosen by the books you love.
Yeah.
They call out to you from the shelf. So, yeah, I think that I wanted to kind of put that excitement around the idea of a class. Sure.
Yeah. And it's funny, now I'm just thinking of this because you're talking about it, but I hadn't thought of it before as like an analogy to reading books. But also there's that aspect of Beljar where the students get kind of swept away into a sort of like dream state in doing their studies. And I won't go into too much detail
yeah.
about that, but that sort of reminds me of reading a good book too, actually.
It is, yeah. Reading a good book is so crazy sometimes because
yeah.
you really believe that world. It's sort of like looking at shadows on a cave wall and being fascinated.
Yeah.
You really believe what's going on, even as you know it's not really happening. You can feel feelings. You know, that whole study that was done that showed that people who read fiction had a greater capacity for empathy. I believe that. I'm not surprised by that, because
mm-hmm.
you're immersed in this world. And I think that with Beljar, I just wanted to kind of convey that intensity, the power not just of reading but also of writing, because the students in the novel and in the class are given these red leather journals to write in, and when they write in them, they go into a kind of magical world. For me, while there is magic realism in the book, and I hope that, you know, my teenage readers and adult readers enjoy it, it also serves as a metaphor for the idea about words transporting you.
Yeah, that's great. I was so transported, I didn't think of it at the time. So.
Oh, well, that's fine. You don't need to think about it.
I want to talk a little bit about Mrs. Cannell. I think another thing that's really important at that time in a person's life is having a special teacher, somebody
yeah.
who might step in and change your life when you need that, or offer you opportunity to change your own life. I think everybody has those teachers, and some people have more than one. So I was going to ask, if it's not too personal, who was that for you?
Well, you know, I have an interesting story about that. I had a teacher in high school who taught Bible as literature and was a faculty advisor on the literary magazine that I was editor of, and was just so wonderful and invited me and other students, you know, to visit her at her beautiful house in the country. And she was just delightful. She was older. She seemed magical. She wrote poetry. She was terrific. We stayed in touch for a very, very long time. And she just died this year. And
mm-hmm.
one thing about her is that she talked about having a son who was a writer. And when I was in high school, you know, he was just, I think he'd had a book, but I didn't know of it, and I didn't know of him. I didn't know anything anyway. But at any rate, time passed, and her son was Tracy Kidder.
Oh, my gosh.
Mrs. Kidder, my teacher. So
wow.
That was kind of great. So she had, you know, students she loved and a son who was an amazing writer, is Absolutely. An amazing writer. And I owe so much to Mrs. Kidder. I really do.
That's a great story. Wow. Yes. Now, do you ever cross paths with Tracy Kidder? Have you ever told him this story?
I have told him. Yes, I have met him. And I haven't, you know, I don't really know him, but I've always exchanged. We've had some exchanges over the years. Absolutely.
That's great. All right, so the second part of this question is, did you ever worry, once you'd started writing about special topics in English, that you'd set yourself a monumental task in writing Mrs. Cannell? Was that ever overwhelming to you because these people are so, I don't know, they're so special?
Well, Mrs. Cannell is, you know, she's one of those sort of magical teachers who's older and a bit, you don't really know her, but she just seems to kind of have all the knowledge of the world.
Yeah.
And she kind of does. And she's a little tough with the kids because even though the school is described in the brochure as being for emotionally fragile, highly intelligent teenagers, we find out that she doesn't view them as fragile. She mm-hmm. views them as brave. And that's different. That's a really different thing. I think that if you don't set yourself a monumental task when you're writing, what are you doing? You know?
Right.
So I like to try to challenge myself to write about characters and to go places where I'm not sure how I'm going to get out of that locked room.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that's great. Do you mind if I read just a couple lines from the book and then
no,
we can talk
thanks.
About them? So this is from pretty early on, and Jam is talking about this boy who she loved who she lost. And she says, it's funny how you can go for a long time in life not needing someone, and then you meet them, and you suddenly need them all the time. This, to me, really nicely encapsulated something exciting but sometimes painful about growing up. That sense of discovering people who understand you and become a part of you outside of your family when you're like a teenager, that first experience with love or friendship. So I just wonder if we can talk about that. And I think that's part of the intensity of character you were trying to develop that you talked about before. But maybe we can talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the moments that are important in a lot of books take place when there's no, say, adult supervision, when you're kind of allowed to find your cohort, when you're allowed to find your people. And these kids who seem very, very different from one another, who are thrown into this class for reasons that they don't understand, mm-hmm. they find that they do have something in common. They've each sort of had a kind of trauma, and the traumas are very different. And you could, I suppose, make a hierarchy of them and say, well, this one isn't as traumatic as that one. But of course, as one character says to another in the book, well, it may not be the worst thing in the world, but it's the worst thing that happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to write about that moment when people understand each other. I think it's just so important. And nobody I know has forgotten that moment with their friends. I mean, I have my closest friend I met at summer camp, actually, when I was a teenager. Just, you know, and we love to talk about our friendship. And we empty rooms talking about our friendship. But there is something to be said, as everybody knows who has long-term friendships.
Absolutely.
There's something to be said for those people because they were there at the moment when you were, you know, finding each other and finding the world.
Mm-hmm. And figuring out who you were going to be. And
Yeah.
I talked to my best friend from high school yesterday for a long time, and we laughed a lot.
Nice. Yeah.
Okay, so this is another little bit from the book. At one point, the class is talking about Sylvia Plath and her themes of isolation. And the line is, everyone is paying very close attention to her, Mrs. Cannell. We're talking about the novel, right? But maybe we're not. We're talking about ourselves. And I guess that's what can start to happen when you talk about a book. I loved that line, that sense. And I'm just wondering if we can talk a little bit about putting that message into the book, that sometimes books get us talking about larger issues, and that's another thing you discover as a teenager.
Yeah. Well, for me, books, I mean, I have such a long, passionate relationship with books and reading and narratives in general, and I almost can't help but put that into everything I write.
Yeah.
Really, it's a little bit meta because the thing is a book, you know, and to write about a book. I've often written about books, actually, and the power of books. I wrote a novel called The Wife about the wife mm-hmm. of a kind of bloated male novelist. I wrote a book called The Position about the kids of parents who write a kind of joy of sex book back in the 70s and what happens to them when they grow up. Books as, again, hot objects, as the thing that opens doors for you. So, you know, I don't know that it's a message exactly as much as it is an obsession of mine to just say repeatedly.
Yeah, okay. Now, one of the book-related stories in this book is Jam's memory of reading Charlotte's Web and realizing for the first time that someday she was actually going to die. And, you know, it's funny, just reading that anecdote of Jam's made me feel like this was a true story. And even though it was brought into the book in a very organic way, I wondered if this happened to you when you read Charlotte's Web.
I can't fool you. Yes, it did. It did. That is actually true. I remember sobbing. I don't think that I mean, I both knew and didn't know about my own mortality in that moment, but I think I really must have known because otherwise, you know, it's a spider, but it's not a spider. It's a person.
And
it's not a person. It's you. It's, you know, that is really what fiction does. It just... You know, you become that person. The person, it just sort of enters you in that way. And I think that I felt really sad. I sort of mourned that. And then you can't really go back. Once you read Charlotte's Web, you can't really go back to not having read it, you know, as much as you might like to. But that's okay, because the book also has a lot of other things to say, too. I mean, about what you can do that's meaningful in your life, about friendships and how meaningful they are, and about being a good writer and things like that, that Charlotte was. So it tempers that idea. It's not, you know, it's not like the existential children's novel. It tempers that idea with important, these are all kind of important ideas. And I think that one of them that I really took from it was about mortality. Mm-hmm. That it was a really, it's a good, you have to learn about it somehow. And what a powerful way to learn about it when you're, you know, seven or so.
Yeah. Now, I wonder if you can name a few other books that were important to you when you were a child or a young adult.
Let's see. Oh, well, certainly A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes, that me too.
The character's name was Meg.
Meg.
Meg Murray, and I was Meg, although I was Margaret for a long time, and then I changed it to Meg, which seemed just to have a little more snap to it, and maybe Meg Murray was an inducement in that direction. But I loved the sort of... the adventure aspect of that book. I really, really, I wasn't a big magic realism person, a big fantasy reader, but I sort of liked the inclusion of fantasy along with sort of the philosophy that was in that book. There was a series of books I loved that most people don't seem to know when I mention it. The Swing in the Summer House and the Diamond in the Window. It was about a group of kids in Concord, Mass., and it had a kind of, like, the Transcendentalists were sort of in the background of this book. The family, there was, like, a bust of Thoreau or something, and there was, in one book, what I remember is that there was a gazebo, a summer house with, like, you know, six sides, and it had a swing, and you would go on the swing, and you could kick through the different panels depending on what the angle of your swing was. And each panel led to a different world. And I just craved that more than anything. You know, I just, the different worlds. And that's, I guess, one way that you enter being a writer is because you do crave those worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Now, how about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Did you enjoy going through that wardrobe, or was that not one of yours?
That wasn't one of mine then, but it was one of mine with my kids, and
okay.
I quite liked it, but later on, and I never did Lord of the Rings or any of that, I have to say. I went from those childhood fantasy ones to kind of more gritty, realistic teenage stuff about often girls, you know, with emotional problems, and pregnancy was another one that was kind of big. There was a book that I loved, My Darling, My Hamburger by Paul
Mandel.
You know that one?
I do know that one.
Books with kind of lurid covers. It was a wonderful book. that was one that I liked a lot.
What about Judy Blume? Did you go through Judy Blume?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. You know, I think it was a little old, but to catch her in the first... I was just aging out of the first wave, but yeah. Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is a terrific book, and I really, really loved it. And I read it and was very affected by it, but then I was sort of, I think because of my age, sort of reading, you know, adult stuff pretty soon thereafter. But that was such a natural, what I like about Judy Blume is the naturalism with which she writes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are not like issues books. Although, of course, I like those, too. I kind of... But Judy Blume is fantastic.
Now, teenagers can be kind of melodramatic.
Yeah.
And I would think this needs to be represented in a young adult story that's going to be honest. But that also makes me wonder, I've never written for YA, is it harder when you write for teens to stay real but avoid tipping over into sentimentality in the work?
You know, I don't really view it in that kind of outside to inside way. I mean, it really more, the drama comes from characters.
Mm-hmm.
So if I think that approaching it from the outside, like, you know, is this going to be sentimental or, okay, now I can put in this much drama, I can put in this much not drama, is going to lead to problems. For me, using characters as, you know, guides into whatever you want to say and having them be real, feel like real, real people is the best way to write, because then you're not writing in a messagey way. You're not just sort of saying, oh, now I'm going to, you know, temper the sentiment with realism. The characters, it's through the integrity of the characters' authenticity that some of these things come about.
Right. Okay. I will say, though, that I noticed there was one scene where I think your characters started to feel like they were acting, maybe not melodramatic, but a little bit young. And you actually
right.
handled it by naming it, which was great. There's this moment where they're coming up with a secret name for their group, and that name will eventually
right.
be Beljar, right?
Right.
Jam says, I feel like we're a group of grade schoolers trying to name their crime-solving or bottle recycling club. That was great. You know, it was just like, I thought, yes, she would be a little embarrassed, and yet she would be really getting into it, and that felt so real to me. So.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, I mean, I think there are moments when we all feel in our lives that, oh, that's not who we want to be, you know, oh, that's too... Like, I'll sometimes feel like the opposite of that. Like, if I'm on a huge jag of, you know, watching British mystery shows and eating soup, like, oh, what am I, 90? What am I, 90 here? What is this? What is this? You know, this is what I want to do on a Saturday night. I used to go to the Mud Club in the 80s. I mean, so, you know, you have a moment of sort of correction or at least awareness of... that something seems like someone older or someone younger. And I think for teenagers, yeah, I mean, they are not long from childhood. It's such a huge leap. It's such a huge leap to make from being not a teenager to being a teenager. I mean, my kid, he changed so radically.
Right.
It's like, it's just incredible. So I think that there would be moments when they would catch themselves and say, oh, right, that's young.
Yeah. Now, do you still have a kid at home, or are your kids...
No, now I have one in college and one in law school, so...
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But they come and go, you know, like, they're always sort of here, you know, somebody... But no, nobody lives at home, but, like, they show up, which is nice.
Yeah, it is. So, an aspect of this novel that I really enjoyed was that we learn each of the students' stories over time, but gradually, as the larger story unfolds. And so, it's like chapter by chapter, we get each student from this special topics class telling his or her story. So, can you talk about working in that way, and was that fun?
Yeah, it's very enjoyable to be able to kind of move from one person to another. And it's a little tricky, you know, for people who are writing students and they're always sort of asking about questions about first person versus third person. And, you know, there are ways around the limitations of one versus another. And mm-hmm. I think here, while the book is in first person and I wanted to do it in first person, I had to think of a way that we could hear these other stories too. So I just sort of let them talk, and I enjoyed being able to do that. You know, it involved like a lot of paragraphs that begin with quote marks, which I'm very unused to doing. Mm-hmm. But just let them tell their stories. Just let them talk. It was kind of liberating.
And again, just so what would happen, you know, I mean, this group of kids, first they meet in class, but they also meet secretly, privately, apart from class. And that seems just like that's what would happen. They would get together and talk and tell each other their stories.
I mean, it's kind of a fantasy, the idea that, first of all, you're away from your parents, but second of all, you can sort of go off to secretly to the classroom at night with a candle and tell each other things you couldn't tell anybody else. I mean, that to me stands for that kind of privacy and intimacy of first revelations that I think people need when they're that age.
Mm-hmm. And you already mentioned that journals are very important in Beljar, you know, the red leather journals that they all get from Mrs. Cannell. So I just wondered if you keep a journal. Did you as a teenager? Do you think writers generally benefit from keeping journals?
I have never kept a journal in my life. I was a very bad diarist and would sort of forget to write in it. I think I was always writing stories, and I think for me, maybe writing stories was my journal, really. That was my record. It wasn't a record of my daily life, but it was a record of things I was exploring as a writer, certainly. So I just, you know, there's just so much energy you have, and there's just so much you can write in a given day. And to this day, I would rather write fiction than write in a journal.
Do you keep notes anywhere? Like when you are out in the world and you have a thought, will you make a note, or does that not need to happen because it all mostly happens when you sit down to write?
I do make notes. I make notes of, like, titles of things. Like, sometimes they're titles of books within a book or a line, an idea. But I put them on stickies on my computer, and I thought for a long time that everything was being saved when I backed up, and for some reason none of it showed up. So all of those ideas were lost, and yet I can't quite believe that I didn't get something out of having, you know, laid down the neural pathways thinking about them. You know, they got, well, at least I have to sort of tell myself that or I'll feel too sad.
Was there a certain period of time over which that happened, or was it just like 6 months of thoughts?
Years.
Oh, no.
Years. But I remember some of it, but I feel bad about it. Maybe they're still in there and still accessible. I don't really know. And I could probably recreate them. That's the thing. It's not like you lose your thoughts. I mean, you are probably able to access a lot of stuff if you really concentrate.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It always blows me away when I read about writers who had a draft of something and it was lost, like in a fire, and then they start all over. It's like, I don't think I could even approach that.
Oh, I know, but that's different. I mean, I print out my work, I back up my work, I send it to myself, I put it, you know, it's in emails, it's everywhere. Yeah.
It's in clouds.
I don't trust. But with my actual writing, I make sure there's no reason at this point in time to lose anything.
Yeah. Now, are you one of those writers who writes every single day? I'm wondering.
No. When I'm writing a book, when I'm like in the deep part of a book, I want to write every single day, and I probably do. But when I'm kind of early on or figuring it out, I'll go days just sort of like eating, you know, walking around, doing things that are somehow related in a way, just kind of gearing up for the task at hand.
Right.
But okay. I like to write every day, but that's a luxury, I think, that I just, there are periods where I just don't have it going, so I can't do it.
How about retreats? I'm just wondering, are you still at a point in your career where you might go off for a writing retreat, or is that something that you don't
do? I haven't. You know, I went to the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire, and to Yaddo, the artist colony in in New York and Saratoga Springs. And I haven't been to either one since before my children were born, just because you get busy, you know, and then you live in your family, and the idea of sort of breakfast with strangers is something you'd have to kind of get used to all over again. But, of course, the point of going there is not to have breakfast with strangers, but is because of the to partake of the amazing solitude and lack of need to kind of take care of other people, which you know, you're freed from when you're in one of these places. But I could imagine doing it again. I'm not there yet, but I could imagine doing it again.
Mm-hmm. It seems almost like a little bit of a waste to do it when you didn't have children yet.
Oh, right. I know. No, but you know, it wasn't. I mean, I know, but it's so strange. Like, you would think, right? Like that's the time that you'd want to go away most. But that was the time I wanted to go away least. Because even if I had gone away then, I think I would have been drawn, you know, I would have had one foot
too distracted
what was going on at home. I think so. Yeah.
We talked about the books that you read when you were young. I'm wondering, what are you reading these days that you might recommend, or something that that's meant a lot to you as an adult that you might recommend?
I really loved the Edward St. Aubin novels, the Patrick Melrose novels, the suite of books that came out over quite a few years.
Right.
Aldrich Schreiter. Those were really powerful to me. They really explored, they were, you know, autobiographical and explored this hellish family situation in which the author seems to have grown up. They were novels too, so I don't know the extent of, you know, at any rate, they were drawn from some of his early experiences, from what I've read, and they're brilliant. They're just brilliant and bold, and I think to be bold, and that doesn't have to mean writing autobiographically, but to try to be bold in your work is something that I would always want to do, and that I tell students to, I encourage students to remember to do.
Mm-hmm. How much do you teach? How full on is that?
It's not full on. I like it, but I try to do it just once in a while.
Okay.
I'm on the faculty at SUNY Stony Brook, Southampton. Mm-hmm. I teach in the summer, and I'm teaching an MFA class this spring. I was teaching at Princeton last fall, a special class that had a performance aspect to it.
Special topics?
kind of, in its own way. It was a class in adaptation, and I taught it with a friend who's a composer and a singer.
Oh, cool.
We used the students to kind of work out ideas that we were thinking about moving from one form to another. So a scene might become a song, a song might become a monologue. It was really kind of wonderful, beautiful class.
Yeah, oh, that's great. All right, so I was going to ask, what are you working on these days?
Well, I am working on an adult novel, and mm-hmm. I just signed up two more YA books, so that awaits
great.
Me in the future, and I have an idea for the first one, but I got to finish the adult novel first, so that's really what I'm spending my days on.
And how far are you with that?
Somewhere around, I don't even know. Mathematically, I just don't know. I'm not at the point yet where I'm writing every minute of every day. I really want to get to that point. But I'm,
okay.
you know, I am talking about this book, Beljar, and doing things Beljar related. So it's a little difficult when you have, you know, you have a couple of books that you're thinking about. But I'm happy to live by my wits in this way. I mean, it really is what I wanted. So I'm certainly not complaining. But I'm, you know, I write on airplanes and in hotels when I have to be away. Yeah, I've become pretty rigorous. I've always been very disciplined. I mean, you have to make your own hours when you're a writer, which for some people would be a terrible thing. For me, it's pretty good. I like to have the freedom during the day to sort of nap and work late at night, whatever it is. But I'm really kind of, I think pretty soon I'll be in that round-the-clock phase.
Now, when you're working on marketing one of your books, like Beljar, going on a book tour, talking to people mm-hmm. like me, is it hard for you to kind of separate those parts of your life, the kind of like sales part and the creative part? Not that this is not creative, this conversation, but you know what I mean? Like the part where you're talking about a finished product versus working on something new.
Well, it used to be that they were kept so separate. I mean, and everybody comments on the fact that the things that we like about the writers we like, you know, has nothing to do with whether they'll be good to have on a radio show or
right.
to give a reading. I mean, or to even be able to talk about their own work or give a pitch about it or a soundbite about it. It used to be that, you know, you just did your work and somebody else took care of this other stuff. But now I think writers are asked to be both the introverts that they need to be to write and the extroverts that they need to be to talk about the writing. Mm-hmm. That's hard. But some of us who studied acting at camp, have like this leftover hammy quality that I hope I can access a little bit when talking about my work. Because, I mean, there's just so much you can say. I like talking about my work. What I like about it, actually, I am one of the people who likes it. What I like about it is that it does sometimes get you thinking about it, which can be useful when you're working.
Okay, oh, that's great. That's a good way to think about it. All right, so I have one last question for you, Meg. As a seasoned writer, but one who's relatively new to writing for a younger audience, do you have any advice for beginning YA writers?
Yeah, I would say just write the book that you would have wanted to find when you were younger. You know, you can worry about updating it or whatever later. I think that writing, rather than looking to the outside for what do kids today want, think about yourself as your ideal reader, your younger version of yourself. And that way you'll be able to write a book that you're passionate about, rather than thinking this is what will sell or what kids today want. Just think about the book you would have wanted, and you can update it or change it later.
Okay, great. That's great advice. So I just want to say one more time, the book is Bell Jar by Meg Wolitzer, published by Dutton. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today. This is really, really great.
Oh, my pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview from the archives with the author Meg Wolitzer. You can learn more about her work at megwolitzer.com and her publisher's website, penguinrandomhouse.com. On that site, on her author page, there's a little bit more information about some of her more recent books, including the picture book that came out this year, Millions of Maxes. All right. Seedlings, soil, compost, fertilizer. It is gardening season. So this week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a garden. Perhaps a small mystery, a missing plant, a wrong fruit, an illegally felled tree. If a mystery doesn't inspire you, maybe write a poem or a scene that takes place in a secret or famous garden, or a former garden that's been paved over and turned into a parking lot. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and good luck with your gardening if you do that. And tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I want to talk a little bit about the Vermont Reads 2022 Choice, which is The Most Costly Journey, El Viaje Más Caro, which tells the stories of 19 Latin American dairy farm workers in Vermont. Over 1,000 migrant laborers from Mexico and other countries milk cows, fix tractors, shovel manure, and take care of calves in our state. And this book is concerning that. The Vermont Humanities Council invites Vermont communities to take part in Vermont Reads 2022 by planning projects that are centered around this book, The Most Costly Journey, and its themes of migration, farming, mental health, cartooning, family, labor movements, and the Latinx experience. So the start date for Vermont Reads 2022 is July 1st. Applications for projects are being accepted through June 30th, 2023. You can find more information at vermonthumanities.org. Whew. Okay, I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. Just a reminder, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. And you can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. And I like to say every week, if you like the show, please rate it wherever you find it. Talk about it with people who might enjoy the show. So up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. In the meantime, I'm going to be playing some music for you. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.